My guest tonight, Oliver Stone, knows a bit about The Doors. His co-author, Peter Kuznick, here to talk about their massive work, The Untold History of the United States, now available in paperback. The Showtime documentary series is now available on DVD and Blu-ray. If you haven't seen any of that, it's pretty compelling viewing, and I urge you to check it out. When we come back, a little bit about the NSA and this massive surveillance program. Also, we'll talk about JFK and then the war on drugs and whatever else we can get to. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast. We're back with Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick, co-authors of The Untold History of the United States. As mentioned at the top of the program, there was a protest. Thousands of people showed up in Washington this weekend to complain about the NSA and its massive surveillance program. Oliver, you guys sort of predicted this. I mean, it was predictable that that something like this, this NSA apparatus, would emerge. But was it inevitable, you think?
In a way, yes, I think it was, because, I mean, Bush was the one who broke the laws. We had, in the 1970s, when the Church Committee found all this damning evidence the CIA had been interfering in other countries' business affairs and so forth, and political affairs, there was a sense of fear in this country because of the Nixon Watergate, that surveillance was a coming thing. There was a wonderful movie Francis Coppola did, The Conversation. All of a sudden, the idea of being, of bugging, of not even bothering with old-fashioned wiretaps became very popular. And I don't know if you ever saw the movie 1999, Enemy of the State.
Sure.
Will Smith. It's a terrific movie, and it was prescient of its time. So I think when they put into effect in 1978 the FISA courts, FISA, you know, to watch over our security, they were supposed to be representing the people in secret courts that would tell the government they could go, only do so much, they can't go so far. To what were they protecting this against? I guess communism at that point, correct? So you know, the FISA courts came into being, but they weren't effective. Because they give the government permission to do anything it wants. But Bush, all of a sudden, in 2003-04, decides that he's going to eavesdrop on everybody. Everybody. He's not even going to even ask for permission anymore. He goes beyond the FISA courts. And he breaks the law, and he gets away with it. And Obama knows that. Never prosecuted him. Never prosecuted Cheney or any of that gang. Let it go. And when he let it go, it just got bigger and bigger. And these people inside a machine, you know, Tom Drake, was busted by them because he brought it out. So, and we met a few other people who actually went against the NSA. They were employees. And Snowden's the last one among them, but we met several. At least I did. I don't know if Peter did. But these are courageous people. Courageous people. And they're giving up their lives for this. And they're being busted one after the other. And Obama's been relentless in his in tracking down whistleblowers. It's scary. It's a scary time.
It is. You know, I had Tom Drake on this program more than a year and a half ago. And, you know, the things he were saying are absolutely true, but he couldn't prove them. Snowden's documents proved a lot of these, and that seems to have gotten people interested in the topic. But, you know, Peter, what drives me crazy is the how many times you hear somebody say, you know, I don't have anything to hide. Let them go ahead and tap my phone. That drives me crazy.
Yeah, and it should. And the other thing that you hear, the U.S. government says, well, everybody does it. Well, it's not true that everybody does it. And you see the reaction now from Angela Merkel and from Hollande. The Germans and the French are furious. It's interesting that initially the German government did protest when they thought that only the German people were being spied on. When Merkel finds out that we're actually listening in on her own conversations, then she blows a gasket. Then she gets very, very upset. Well, if the Germans and the French are so upset, they should do what our friend Glenn Greenwald just told them they should do. They should show it by giving asylum to Edward Snowden.
Yeah.
Let them show a little backbone over there. Let them do something to say to the United States, you can't get away with this kind of impunity. And people should be upset. And the American people are upset also. The extent of the surveillance, the Stasi, the German Stasi is often held up, the East German Stasi, as a model for the kind of invasive surveillance that Orwell was talking about in 1984. Well, their motto was to know everything about everybody. They were bumblers. They were amateurs. They couldn't do it. But with our modern technology and our capabilities, the U.S. government now can do that, and they are doing that. And as Oliver has said, well, maybe Obama is not going to use it in the worst possible way, but how do we know who's going to be in there next? How do we know that the next president is not just going to look at the metadata, but he's going to start to listen in on all those phone calls? We are developing the capabilities to do that level of surveillance now. And that is, Obama pledged to be the transparency president? Well, that's a joke.
Yeah, no, this is very disturbing because he says, you know, you have nothing to worry to, and he seems like a very reasonable man, an intelligent man. He's not going to listen to my mail, I know. But on the other hand, other people are, and this is going to go into the future. And in the future, if the situation gets worse with another terrorist incident or another, or two, or anything of that nature, they're going to turn it on, and they're going to go back. Now, but think about it in another way. Think about not just about terrorism, because there's only a few thousand of them, as you say. It's about the civil rights movement, about the labor union movement. It's about the Vietnam War protests, the Iraq War protests. How can these things even start? Imagine the Vietnam students trying to get going, and they're already being tracked by Hoover. Because they're possibly they're communists, right? The Martin Luther King, the civil rights movement. These people are distrusted by Hoover and assumed to be communists. So they put bugs on them. They bug King's rooms. They bug these kids. 500,000 people on a list. But imagine what they could do with this technology now. They can go much further.
And there's no checks and balances, no effective checks and balances.
The ability to protest. I was in the Soviet Union in the 1980s at the end of communism. It was a very interesting time. I was there to write a script about the dissident movement because I was fascinated by the Sakharov, people who were taking on the state. These people, many of them had suffered, been sent to psychiatric clinics and jails. They were very damaged, some of them, but they really fought on for years. And it was a very strict society, miserable in the sense that it had no economic incentives for the people and no compassion amongst them. It was a tough, falling-apart society. It was clear to me. And everybody was distrusted. I had to meet these dissidents in subways and secret hotel rooms that were hidden away. It was very hard to talk. They were always scared about being overheard as the Stasi state that Peter described. When I left the country, it was 1983, I thought something was so wrong with it, it couldn't possibly last. It was too closed. And sure enough, much to my surprise, out of that system, not Ronald Reagan. Forget this idea that Ronald Reagan destroyed the Soviet Union. No. It was falling apart from within. And Mikhail Gorbachev, who was a bureaucrat, one of the architects of that system. He worked in it from the beginning, from the 1940s on. He was secretary. He was an expert on agriculture, like Henry Wallace in the United States. He saw that the agricultural system was falling apart. He saw everything else, industry, falling apart. Nothing would work without the state subsidizing the military-industry complex in that country. The country was at a dead end, stagnant. And he started to reform it from within. By chance, he became the big dog, and he really started his campaign of perestroika, of reform, internal reform. And out of that grew the need to make a deal with the United States because they were putting too much money into military. And he made that deal with Reagan. He offered him the whole book. He offered to pull out all the troops from Eastern Europe. He let the Berlin Wall come down without any trouble. It was done peacefully, which shocked me. I don't know how old you are, George, but it shocked me. And we never could have imagined that in our lifetime. But this man came out of that system. So we never know. And I think sometimes when that happened, that I think of the United States, because we lost our enemy at that time, that we ourselves are an alter ego to the Soviet Union. We are like them. We have become a state which is stagnant, gridlocked politically, can't do anything, has a huge military that we can't afford, and on top of that are eavesdropping on all our citizens and on all our allies because we're the sole superpower. So I think we've reached a place in history where we can't go on being who we are. We can try, and maybe this will last for another 10 years, I don't know, maybe 20 years, but I know one thing from history. No empire has lasted, no matter how strong it is. In 1941, and Hitler thought he would last forever, a 1,000-year reign. He really did. He looked like he would win everything, including the Soviet Union. He beat them. He would beat them, but he didn't. So, hubris has always played a role in this, and all the devastation, the self-destruction comes from within.
You know, I went out to see this NSA facility in Utah a couple of months ago and work on a story about it. It's massive. It's just gigantic. I had one of the NSA whistleblowers who had worked with Tom Drake who told me that thing is too big to just collect metadata. You could collect all of that in one room, and this thing is several warehouses. It's enough to collect every communication in the world for 500 years, and it's one of six that the NSA has. I think it drives me crazy that people, this is an example of where ignorance of history, as you, the theme of your book, really can be misused, because people not paying attention to this, they don't know how it can work. The fact that once you set up an apparatus like this, it's there for good.
No, it's like we reminded the Soviet Union in 1983. You were saying, Peter?
It's not the kind of issue that breaks down on left-right lines.
No.
It's important for the public to understand. This is something that affects everybody who thinks that they really believe in freedom of any sort. Their freedom is being taken away to an extent that they would not have imagined.
We're talking about this whole. What's shocking about this whole Tea Party revolt in Congress, shutting down Congress about the debt ceiling, was where were they on the NSA? If they're so concerned about government intrusion in our lives, how do they just not even mention that?
Exactly. You would think that that's the point where liberals and conservatives would come together and agree.
I was very disappointed.
It kind of goes hand in hand with the drug war, doesn't it, Oliver? I loved your most recent movie, Savages, about the drug industry and the Mexican mafia moving in on it. And it's sort of the same kind of excesses that have been tolerated in that, where the ends justify the means. And gosh, these dirty druggies, so what if the cops or agencies step over the line a little bit? It's worthwhile.
Right. Now, the DEA is another monstrosity that developed, as did the Homeland Security Agency, unfortunately. It's just they come out of this political fear, you know. It's built up by the politicians, the public. Yeah, they don't want drug crimes. They don't want to have the terrorists on their home ground. So as a result, we overreact in America. When I was a soldier in Vietnam, it was the same thing on a smaller scale. We would get hit. You know, we'd be in combat. We'd be on patrol somewhere. We'd get hit, pull back, and drop bombs. The bigger the hit, the more bombs we drop. Before we knew, we were always constantly reacting, overreacting, and sometimes we lost the enemy. We lost contact with the enemy that way. And it was not effective, and sometimes when we destroyed we had free fire zones on civilians. The same thing is true in a way about the drug war. I mean, once the drugs started to come into the consciousness of the country, which, you know, they were treated far more dangerously than they were, and we created a whole mechanism and in fact, that militarized it, that made it even stronger and bigger, because the agents had to, you know, the agents that we created, the industry that we created to fight it, the prison system needs prisoners. It needs to make busts. It needs to go now into foreign countries and tell foreign countries what to do. In South America, they've always been distrusted as espionage agents. The home countries don't want DE agents on their soil. It's bringing like America to you. It's allowing American intelligence to operate there. And the drugs often get confused with other things like money laundering and terrorism, and they all get wrapped up into one ball of snow. And then next thing you know, we got to build a border wall across Arizona and New Mexico. What is it? It's a ridiculous border wall. It's supposed to keep out the evil from the south. One thing leads to the other, you know, and same thing is true, frankly, about the war on terror.
It's also troubling that the war on terror is privatized to a large degree. We forget that Edward Snowden didn't work for the NSA. He worked for Booz Allen, and he had access to all this stuff. It's troubling not only that the intelligence functions are privatized, but so is the soldiering, the fighting.
And apparently some of the prison system is being, too.
And George, we've got about 1.4 million people in this country with top security clearances. We have this whole state, this secret state that's monitoring everything, that's pursuing all these things. Plus, as you're saying, all the contractors, this massive world of security. In 2009, the National Priorities Project did a study in which they estimated that out of our $3 trillion budget, $1.2 trillion went to military spending, intelligence spending, the broad array of defense. 40% of our budget goes to that. But when you started to talk about drugs, I thought you were going to go with a different DR word. I thought you were going to make the connection with drones to the surveillance.
We can jump into that. Go right ahead. That's another manifestation.
There was a great moment in the White House, in the Oval Office, a few days ago, in which you had two Nobel laureates there together. You had Barack Obama and you had Malala Yousafzai, this 16-year-old Pakistani student who was shot in the head by the Taliban for speaking out in support of girls' right to go to school. And she lectured him. And she said to him, she thanked him for his support for girls getting educated in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And then she said, I also expressed my concern that drone attacks are fueling terrorism. She said, innocent victims are killed in these acts, and that leads to resentment among the Pakistani people. He says, education is important, but you have to stop these drone attacks, which must have been a great moment because Obama's 15-year-old daughter, Malia, was sitting there also. So you've got two Nobel laureates, one who's actually got a moral core and understands the implication of this. Not only is this program deeply immoral, with Obama going week after week, every week, going through the kill list and picking out which individuals or which groups are going to be targeted, but we're actually creating more terrorists. In Yemen, when we started our drone attacks, there were about 300 terrorists. Now there are well over 1,200 terrorists. So we create because we kill civilians or kill other people, and then more and more people rise up who want to kill us. So I think this is a great moment in White House history when Malala was actually lecturing the president from a moral standpoint on what the United States should be doing as opposed to what we are doing.
It kind of goes to that cliche about they hate us for our freedom. Well, you know, maybe some of them hate us for our freedom, but they also hate us because we kill them, a lot of them. You want to talk about that, Oliver?
Well, you're quoting George Bush back in the after the 2001, which I think was we tried to expose that as a lie. And it was clear that this was a blowback situation, and Bin Laden and his group made it clear that they were most upset with the Israeli-Palestine situation, our support of Israel, as well as U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia. Mr. Bush, the father, when he decided that he needed a new war in Kuwait, which he didn't really need, he put 500,000 U.S. troops up in the Holy Land, which is amazing. When you think back about it, it was sort of done with all full approval of Congress, all that. And it was the biggest, you know, overseas expedition since Vietnam. And, you know, all of a sudden, here it was into the Middle East. We just went there. We never had done that before. It's quite an amazing story. And Bush hyped it. He hyped it with stories that were publicized by a public relations firm hired by the Kuwaiti royal family. It's an ugly story, but here we are again, you know. And that's why they gave us that. And we also had a lot to do with their formation. You know, it was our plan to bring the Russians into Afghanistan, that we loved the idea of it, because then we figured they could be trapped as we were in Vietnam. It was payback. Brzezinski hatched the plan in 78. There's a memo to that effect we put in the movie, as well as the continuation of the policy under Reagan with Bill Casey was the most insane CIA chief we ever had, I believe, next to Alan Dulles. Both of them probably equally insane. But Casey actually wanted a Muslim uprising in the Caucasus in South Russia, which is the old idea of rolling back the Soviet Union, you know, having revolutions on their land. In other words, inside Russia, there'd be a huge uprising, which today is still a big issue, which is why Putin is so tough about Muslim terrorists. He's concerned about it because it would spread to Russia itself.
Well, I think the main thing that I take out of your book, and that I hope people will take out of your book, is there are consequences to our actions. You know, we overthrow the government of Iran, an elected government, put in the Shah, a despot, and we pay for it later. We support somebody like Saddam Hussein, and it comes back to bite us.
It's blowback. It's called Chalmers Johnson, I think, came up with that term and called the book by its name. He's well worth reading, Chalmers Johnson.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, I do want to talk about JFK a little bit. We got an important anniversary coming up, the 50th anniversary of that dark day in Dallas. Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick, co-authors of The Untold History of the United States. Coming up in the second half of the program, Helen Caldicott to talk about the Fukushima disaster and debacle and where things stand over there. And our next segment, Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick, the co-authors of Untold History of the United States, address JFK and other mysteries. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast. In their book, The Untold History of the United States, Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick do not specifically address the JFK assassination or what might have been behind it. However, they do sort of lay the groundwork for some of the folks who had a reason to want Kennedy gone. Oliver, if somebody today were to put a gun to your head and say, we demand that you give us your opinion about whether LBJ knew about this in advance, what would you say?
Well, you're asking me a loaded question there. I would be quoted the wrong way. I am disturbed by a lot of that. But, in our history, we're dealing with a documentary and we're dealing with proven facts, known facts. We had to fact check everything. So we can only speculate about the assassination. The best way to have done that for me was through the movie that I did. And I maintain that it's a very rock solid movie still. And it does show the whole atmosphere and mood of the country at that time. Things have emerged since then. Loopholes have widened. But basically, the evidence that was collected in 63 on that day, on that very day, mostly by the FBI, actually, was so, it's in the answer to this thing is very basic, and it lies in the principles of forensics and the bullet. The magic bullet is just impossible. It's just ridiculous, as well as the concept that Kennedy was killed from the rear. He was the main shot, the kill shot, is on frame 313 of the Zapruder film. Comes from the front, comes from the grassy, from the fence up that knoll, which is the obvious kill spot. He does get shot from the rear, but there's somebody else shooting from the front. So there's at least two shooters. So, and I don't believe, for various reasons of that I know, and it was seen that Oswald was even in the sixth floor window. I believe he was on the second floor. But he was one of the people that was involved in this strange web of people who came to Dallas that day. Go back to the basics of the Zapruder film, the back and to the left, the magic bullet, and the impossibility of the Warren Commission conclusions. Basic stuff. And if, as a combat infantryman in Vietnam, I can tell you, I can assure you that firing a Mannlicher Carcano, which is the worst infantry weapon probably since World War II, it is impossible to have done that damage from the rear on a moving vehicle through a tree.
Because of all the grief that you have taken since the movie came out, I mean, you know more than anyone, and maybe more than anyone in the world, how good some people are at muddying these waters. They want it to be confusing. And I've been reading lately about how this theory that the CIA was involved only came much, much later. Seems to me that was mentioned right from the beginning, wasn't it? Garrison's?
Mark Lane and Jim Garrison, yep. I don't know who came up with what first. But there's a good tradition of people who really doubted this movie. The majority of Americans doubted it, and they still do. And they're never given credence in our so-called Democratic Republic by the establishment press, which continues to deny it and says that the evidence is solid on Oswald. There is no solid evidence on Oswald. It's all invented stuff. This is a very classic case of a black op. Classic case, and I'm not a conspiracy type. I didn't suggest it for 2001. I don't look for these things. I believe in accidents. I believe in single assassins. I believe McKinley was killed by a single assassin. And I think it happens that way. But Oswald had absolutely no hatred for Kennedy. On the contrary, he admired him and said so publicly on a radio station and in a lecture in Louisiana. He really did. And the problem with Oswald is that he becomes many things to many people, but he's a classic kind of a double agent. He works for an organization, the U.S. government, probably the Office of Naval Intelligence, and he probably crosses with the FBI, and he crosses sometimes with the CIA. He may not know if it's the CIA. But this is a story, that leads you on a long path, and it confuses people. But he is not a simple, stupid patsy. I mean, he's not a simple, stupid guy who goes to a window and shoots a president. Not at all.
The clock is ticking, obviously. 50th anniversary coming up in less than a month, and I'm not sure. Are you hopeful that there can be a breakthrough still, or is it going to be?
I never thought that it would be a breakthrough. Now I think that it'd be great to have more records released. That is for sure, because they didn't release everything they promised, but a lot of it was destroyed too and scratched out. The Secret Service records were destroyed when the ARRB went after them and asked for it. Something happened in there in 1996-7. But listen, things continue to come out. When we were in Pittsburgh last week, Dr. McClellan, who was at Parkland, came out. He's 80-some years old, and he said, I stood over Kennedy, trying to save Kennedy's life for 18 minutes. I stared into that brain. It was hardly any brain. It was falling through the cerebellum on the back of his head. Clear as daylight. He got written up in the Pittsburgh papers as a good story, but it never made the Nationals. McClellan was there, you know. And we have so many eyewitnesses to this brain issue. It's insane that there's another brain that's running around here. It was, and I think a major fraud was perpetrated on that autopsy. We know from the film that we made that there was military people all over it. And it's a strange autopsy, the results. The pictures are not recognizable of those people who saw him in Parkland and some of the people who even saw him in Bethesda.
50 years later, it's hard to imagine why there still have to be documents that need to be kept secret. It's also hard to imagine who would still be within the corridors of power that would want to perpetuate a cover-up or perpetuate the untruths that were told about the assassination.
George, I know. I would just suggest that you know, people who are serious, who really would read Robert Grodin's book about, he has photographs, he's a photographic expert, he testified for the House Select Assassinations Committee, he's still alive, and he has a new book called Absolute Proof, picture by picture, frame by frame, just lays it out. Cyril Wecht is another, he's a forensic pathologist who's still working, he's in his 80s. It's written beautifully about it. And there's a new book, JFK and the Unspeakable, by Jim Douglas, that I've always referenced. It just came out about 4 or 5 years ago. It's a brilliant book. And it goes into why there is a power structure in this country that would still be interested in not having this matter come up, of JFK being killed in a coup d'etat. Why? And we have to go into his policies. You've got to follow the policies of Eisenhower before it and then resume the policies of Johnson after it. Peter and I said that Kennedy was a young man. He was taking the country in a young direction, a new direction. The old man took the power back from him.
You know, almost as sad as what happened to John Kennedy is what happened to Jim Garrison, the dismantling of his life, the smearing of him. Yeah. A friend of mine named John Barber had a film about Jim Garrison, the Garrison files, the Garrison tapes, and it's sad. It's a sad thing that they did, but they're good at it.
Jim was an honest man and a great DA, but he did make mistakes on that case. But, you know, he was fighting at that time against what people did not know about, was the covert operations of the United States government. And now with the Snowden revelations, with what happened in Iraq, we're much more able. I think he was the anti-hero of his time. I mean, I think people would now say that he had the guts of a Julian Assange or an Edward Snowden to stand up to the government and try to bring light to this dark spot.
Peter, to bring you into this conversation, sure.
Well, George, in Untold History, what we try to do is paint the bigger picture. And we talk about the fact that Kennedy read an advance copy of the soon-to-be best-selling novel, 7 Days in May, in 1962. And in that movie, a military coup occurs in the United States because a liberal president is trying to end the Cold War, and the military overthrows him. And Kennedy read an advance copy, and he told a friend, he says, it's possible. It could happen in this country. He says, if, for example, the country had a young president and he had a bay of pigs, there would be a certain uneasiness. Maybe the military would do a little criticizing behind his back, but this would be written off as the usual military dissatisfaction with civilian control. Then if there were another bay of pigs, the reaction of the country would be, is he too young and inexperienced? The military would almost feel that it was their patriotic obligation to stand ready to preserve the integrity of the nation. And only God knows just what segment of democracy they would be defending if they overthrew the elected establishment. If there were a third bay of pigs, it could happen. What we argue is that Kennedy had far more than three bays of pigs in the sense that he stood up and defied the leaders in the military and the intelligence community. And they considered it betrayals. There was the first bay of pigs, but he wouldn't send in the support. There was his disempowering the CIA and firing its leaders, that I'm going to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it in the wind. He talked about those CIA bastard and those Joint Chiefs sons of bitches. He refused to get militarily involved in Laos. He neutralized Laos. He concluded the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty, which was anathema to the military. He made clear that he planned to disengage from Vietnam. His commencement address at American University calls for ending the Cold War. He wanted to abandon the space race and work cooperatively with the Soviet Union to explore space. He encouraged third world nationalism, and he refused he did everything he could to avoid a military confrontation during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he also reached out to Castro at the end. So he was going after every fundamental aspect of U.S. policy at the end of his life. And so, you know, I don't say that I know who did it. All I say is I know he had a lot of enemies, who wanted to get rid of him, who thought they had cause to get rid of him.
Excuse me, and enemies with power, too, not just people who were angry with him.
Yeah, people who could do it.
But they got away with it, in a sense.
If you do a coup d'etat, you have to get away with it, otherwise you're finished.
I see the excesses of the NSA. I saw this clip of the head of intelligence agencies standing before Congress. They ask him a question, are you spying on the American public? And he says, no. And there's no downside to that lying. It doesn't seem like there's any downside to what these guys do.
No, there is none. There is none. You can lie. Like Obama was saying, you know, well, we're not listening on your mail. We're just doing metadata, right?
You can lie the country into wars. You can torture. You can break international law. Look what happened in the United States. The people who broke international law, the Bushes and the Cheneys, are walking free. Major General Antonio Taguba, who investigated what happened at Abu Ghraib, said that there is no doubt at all that war crimes were committed. The only question is if anybody's ever going to be held accountable and prosecuted. It was Obama's obligation to prosecute. He refused to do so. So the people who commit war crimes walk free. The people who expose war crimes, the highest patriotic duty, those people are facing life behind bars. We're through the looking glass in some bizarre sense in terms of our values being flipped upside down in this country.
Let's continue the story arc. I'm sure that both of you have thought about the story arc that you tell in The Untold History of the United States. What if there was another 9/11 or something like it? What would the consequences be? You'd have people, whoever was there protesting about the NSA in Washington, that would fizzle, wouldn't it?
No, I hope not. We hope not. Part of what we're doing is also to preempt it. We know that there's a risk of that. We feared that if there were another 9/11 shortly after the first one, that the Constitution was going to be completely ripped up in this country, that it was going to look like a very, very different country, much darker than it looks today. But I hope that the American people have some semblance of balance. You know, we're going to hear the right-wing talk radio shows, and they're going to be shrill and calling for terror, doing away with the Constitution. But there's a lot of people in the military who are resistant to that. There are people throughout society who are resistant to that. I don't think it's going to be quite as easy now as it might have been had it happened in 2002.
And Oliver, do you agree? I mean, imagine that it was a dirty nuke.
I think it's much more fragile than that. I think that the reaction in Boston was insane. I mean, they declared martial law. They closed down the city. They were able to go to any apartment they wanted. And on top of it, you know, our intelligence service had been notified by the Russians about these young kids, or one of them. So, you know, that's the same story as what happened in 2001, and that was what, two bombs, three bombs, two people. We're very fragile. And I repeat, you know, just from history, I've been through, it was in Europe a lot in the 70s, 80s. It was bombing all the time in Britain with the IRA, in Italy with communist brigade. In France, there was all kinds of Mideast intrigue and bombings and killings of civilians in the streets. And in Italy and Japan, each of these countries dealt with terror. You have to deal with terror in your lifetime. You're going to have this element. It's part of life. It's just they're hardliners in every society. But somehow we have nationalized it, collectivized this problem into a world problem. All of a sudden we have said, look, the entire world is on notice. You're with us or you're against us. Terrorism exists in 60 countries, so they say. It's like drug war again, you know. It doesn't make sense. We have to be specific, and we go after the perpetrator, and that's it. We can't start talking about dirty nukes and stuff like that. This is very... because we have very good detective at work, we have very good police work, we have good if we have good international allies, we can find malevolent people who intend harm. We don't have to create this war situation. You understand? And that's the American way. It's always overreaction to things.
And you look at the insanity in Afghanistan, for example. We spend over $100 billion a year in Afghanistan. Our target there really is 50 members of al-Qaeda. The highest limits, higher estimates are 100 members of al-Qaeda. If it's 50, then we're actually spending about $2 billion per al-Qaeda member in Afghanistan. In what universe does that make sense as a policy?
It reminds me of a famous line from Martin Luther King. He said one of his speeches, he said, you know, we spend $350,000 to kill every Viet Cong in Vietnam. We spend at home $50 on every poor child in this country to educate them, to feed them.
And in Afghanistan, a country that's got a life expectancy of 46 years, that may be a quarter of the population or even literate, we spend $100 billion on killing, and we spend less than $2 billion a year on development programs.
I wonder if we're there for the poppies.
Well, at least we get something out of it.
Tell me about the, you know, as I haven't seen the entire DVD series, I'm going to buy it. I think it's powerful and important. Is there any interest in an extended series, doing more parts?
Actually, we added two more parts to the series that we didn't show on Showtime, and those are fabulous also.
Yes, I think you should get it, for Christ's sake.
I am going to get it, but I just didn't know if if it was enough of a hit for Showtime that they want you to do more.
I don't know. We have to go into an epilogue. We finish in 2013.
Right. Well, I know as I watched the Vietnam episode, for example, I wanted more, you know, and I know how you feel about Vietnam.
When you see the Bush Obama episode, the Age of Terror, I think I think we have to get past this stage first. Because
We showed that one yesterday at UC Irvine.
We've turned this into the War of the Worlds in a way.
Is there any appetite for incorporating it into curriculum? Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Let me mention one thing first.
Sure.
My guess is that you have a lot of people listening who might be truck drivers or on the roads at night. What I would suggest that some of them consider doing is getting the audiobook version of Untold History. It's 26 discs, but it's fabulous. It's been read brilliantly, and they're available on Amazon, on iTunes, and at audible.com. So people can listen to them. I listen to it when I drive long distances. It's been read so powerfully that you convey the entire book, and which goes into a lot more information than the documentary. But we think people need to read the book or listen to the book and watch the documentary, because they're very, very different kinds of experiences.
Well, it's like the old cliche, if you don't pay attention to history, you're doomed to repeat it. And that lesson comes through loud and clear in your book.
Yeah.
Oliver Stone, Peter Kuznick, thank you both very much. I encourage people to check out.
Thank you for having us.
I do. I hope you'll come back again sometime. Untold History of the United States, in hardback, in paperback, and the DVDs. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Dr. Helen Caldicott is going to join us to talk about Fukushima. If you thought that mess over there at that nuke plant had been cleaned up, you are wrong. It's sort of dropped off the face of the earth in terms of mainstream media coverage, at least in this country. But poison continues to pour into the ocean. And some of that poison has been detected, nuclear poisoning in off the coasts of the United States. It is spreading around the world, causing incalculable damage, as Dr. Caldicott will tell us. I want to say thank you to Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick again for joining us. And we're going to go to a break now. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM.